Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show where we cut through the noise and get right to the knowledge. I'm Joe Cunningham, and I'll be your guide as we navigate today's sources.
And I'm Lee Meacham, ready to connect the dots and provide the crucial context you need to truly be well-informed.
Our focus today is a comprehensive, exhaustive, and really detailed exploration of the newsstand. We're doing a deep dive into Newsweek USA for the week of October 31st, 2025.
That's right. And this issue, wow, it's packed. It's a real gold mine covering, you know, everything from these huge shifts in global defense spending.
Right.
And the psychology driving the American workforce right now, all the way through to, well, the technical specs of Ferrari's electric future, believe it or not.
And even a major new ranking of the nation's top hospitals. There's a lot here.
A ton.
So our mission today is to really extract the most important insights from every single piece of this magazine. We want to give you the complete nuanced picture of the issues shaping the end of October 2025.
Yeah, it's about more than just, you know, summarizing the headlines. It's understanding the ripple effects, isn't it?
Yeah.
How these things connect across culture, the economy, global stability.
We're aiming to go beyond those headlines, understanding the implications, like you said, the implications of these defense spending shifts or the sort of hidden anxiety in the job market.
And even the contradictions Ken Burns explores in America's founding story. It's all in here.
Okay, let's dive in. Let's unpack this magazine, starting immediately with, well, a fascinating look at geopolitics, but viewed through a very personal and, frankly, quite surprising lens.
Right. This first piece focuses on Natasa Pirkmusar. She's the president of Slovenia.
A small country, often overlooked, but seems to have an oversized voice right now.
Exactly. Slovenia, you know, it's geographically smaller than Houston, Texas. Tiny.
Yeah.
But Pirkmusar, she's managed to strategically place herself and Slovenia right in the middle of the global conversation.
And how?
Yeah.
Largely through a really unusual professional connection, right?
That's the one. Her former role is Melania Trump's lawyer.
Which is just wild to think about for a sitting European head of state. The piece says she handled cases for Melania Trump between 2016 and 2019. That's a unique link to U.S. politics.
And it's not just history. The report confirms that connection is, well, still active.
Yeah.
Pirkmusar mentions she still communicates with the former first lady.
Really?
Yeah, says Melania Trump, still immediately replies to her emails. And maybe importantly for that connection to home, hasn't forgotten her mother tongue, Slovenia.
And this personal relationship, it actually feeds directly into a political narrative, doesn't it? Pirkmusar sees Melania Trump as a kind of softening influence on President Trump.
That's the idea she puts forward. And look, in today's highly charged global politics, the idea of any personal moderating force, especially one connected to a small EU and NATO state, well, that becomes a pretty significant strategic asset.
It gives Slovenia a unique channel.
Definitely. And that strategic value, that sort of Melania Trump soft power, it was apparently tested and demonstrated back in August 2024. Pirkmusar brings up this missive Melania Trump wrote directly to Vladimir Putin.
Oh, I remember hearing something about that. It was an appeal, wasn't it? About children caught in the war.
Exactly. Appealing for the protection of children imperiled by the war. And according to the article, Melania Trump told reporters this effort actually resulted in a reported reunion of 8 Ukrainian children with their families.
Wow, so not just symbolic then?
Apparently not. And Pirkmusar uses this specific example to argue that Europe also needs to keep open channels with Russia. It positions her and Slovenia as this pragmatic voice for dialogue, even as the rest of the continent is maybe focusing more on isolation and defense buildup.
Okay, so that's the soft power angle. But the conversation, it takes a sharp turn, doesn't it, towards a pretty detailed critique of the Trump administration's foreign policy.
A very sharp turn. Pirkmusar argues, quite unequivocally, that the U.S. is, in her words, striding away from its reputation as a beacon for human rights, democracy, and promoting international law.
That is a heavy statement coming from an ally, a NATO ally. It really makes you ask, what specific actions are driving this perception, this idea of American decline in principles?
Well, she doesn't just make the accusation. She backs it up with three pretty powerful examples. Examples, she says, show how recent U.S. actions are actively undermining the very international institutions designed to uphold global order.
And her warning is stark. She says, to violate international law is the biggest crime a country can do, and that losing credibility, it takes years to regain.
It's a chilling quote, really.
Okay, let's break down those three specific critiques she levels. They really highlight this conflict between current U.S. policy and, well, global legal norms. The first one focuses on the U.S. sanctioning international criminal court judges.
Exactly. This whole situation arose over the ICC issuing warrants against Israeli leaders. Berk Musar specifically points out the difficulties faced by a Slovenian judge, Beatty Holler, whose work, she says, has been severely hampered by these U.S. sanctions.
So the implication is the U.S. is essentially punishing judges for doing their jobs.
That's the core of the critique. By actively punishing these judges, the U.S. signals that its commitment to the rule of law is, let's say, conditional. It only applies when the outcome aligns with U.S. political interests. It effectively isolates the U.S. from these core global legal bodies.
Okay, that's critique number one. The second one addresses the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, specifically the U.S. vetoing U.N. resolutions demanding a ceasefire.
Right, and the political damage there is undeniable. The article quotes the Palestinian ambassador to the U.N., Riyad Mansour. He argued the U.S. veto stopped the Security Council from playing its rightful role in addressing the crisis.
So for nations committed to multilateralism, like Slovenia presumably is, seeing the U.S. use its veto like that,
it looks like actively obstructing global efforts to end conflict. It reinforces this perception that the U.S. prioritizes its alliances, perhaps, over global human rights imperatives. That's the argument being made.
And the third critique, this one sounds particularly troubling. It questions the legality of direct U.S. military action, something about strikes on alleged drug boats.
Yes, in international waters. Recent lethal strikes launched by the Trump administration on supposed drug boats in the Southern Caribbean. These were aimed at what the administration termed narco-terrorists.
But it raised legal red flags.
Big ones. Regarding international maritime law, ethics. And the report includes this really concerning detail. Military lawyers apparently encouraged commanders to ignore the standard process for getting sign-off on these operations.
Whoa.
Yeah. Which suggests, or at least raises the question, that the administration might have been willing to circumvent established legal procedures. It blurs the line between, you know, robust enforcement and potentially disregarding international legal frameworks. It's a serious indictment of respect for legal restraint, if true.
So Pirk Musar's overall view is one of profound alarm, it sounds like. She thinks President Trump is trying to fix things his own way, but...
But she doesn't believe the U.S. can keep going down this unilateral path without severe long-term damage to its global standing. That's the essence of her warning.
And this kind of geopolitical instability, this nervousness, it inevitably leads back to defense spending, doesn't it? Especially for NATO members.
Absolutely. Pirk Musar observes that internal disunity is making Europe weak. And the U.S. tendency to swivel elsewhere, you know, shift its strategic focus, that's forced Europe to scramble to reevaluate its own military plans at a furious pace.
And this reevaluation, it comes with some concrete and honestly eye-watering financial targets. Slovenia, for instance, hasn't met the existing NATO benchmark of 2% GDP on defense.
Though they're on track this year, the article notes. But the real headline, the structural change detailed here, is this massive new NATO target.
Right. This is the big one.
Agreed in June, apparently. A new target, 3.5% of GDP purely on military hardware, plus another 1.5% on related investment infrastructure readiness.
So that totals 5%.
5% of GDP over the next decade.
5%. That is a staggering leap, especially when you consider Slovenia was spending less than, what, 1.4% just last year?
It's immense. This isn't just a line item adjustment in a budget. It represents a fundamental societal choice about priorities.
And a choice that's already causing friction.
You bet. The article points to immediate societal pushback. It mentions posters appearing in Ljubljana, the capital, with a message translating roughly to, "We want 5% in beer, not in weapons."
Beer versus bullets. That captures it perfectly, doesn't it? The public struggle, the human cost of prioritizing massive military spending over maybe domestic quality of life.
It really does.
The conversation also touches on Slovenia's specific regional sensitivities. Pirk Musar explains why Slovenia might be more sensitive to the plight of Palestinians compared, perhaps, to the war in Ukraine, which is geographically closer to some other allies.
Yeah, she connects this sensitivity directly to the very fresh memory of the 1995 Srebrenica genocide in Bosnia.
Ah.
For a nation born for the breakup of Yugoslavia, atrocities, humanitarian crises right on its borders, those aren't abstract historical events. That deep internalized memory gives Slovenia, she argues, a more empathetic, maybe even more activist stance regarding the situation in Gaza.
That makes sense. Finally, the discussion shifts to the modern face of conflict. These hybrid threats, drone incursions, things that test NATO's boundaries without necessarily being full-scale attacks.
Right. We hear about recent incidents mentioned in the report. Poland reporting about 20 Russian drones crossing its border. Estonia, a Baltic state, reporting 3 Russian MiG-31s violating his airspace for 12 minutes.
Clear provocations. Low-level tests designed to probe the alliance's reaction, its unity.
Precisely. Yeah. And Prick-Musar's reaction to these, it aligns with her general philosophy. Cautious, maybe even pacifistic. She advocates for NATO aircraft to simply escort Russian jets out of violating airspace.
Prioritizing a measured response rather than shooting them down.
Exactly. Which, the article notes, is a more aggressive option that President Trump and the head of the EU executive arm have publicly stated is on the table.
So she's pushing back against that escalation.
She is. And she concludes this really powerful segment with a personal declaration that kind of defines her whole approach.
Yeah.
I'm a pacifist by heart. I wish that politicians would use words and not guns.
Wow. Seeking dialogue and restraint in the face of escalating military budgets and tension. That really sums up Slovenia's strategy here.
It seems central, yes.
Okay, that's a remarkable overview. How personal ties, regional history, they all influence global policy. It paints this picture of intense global anxiety driving massive state-level decisions. Now, let's switch gears completely. We're moving from those huge global shifts to the financial security anxieties gripping the U.S. labor market right here at home.
Yeah, the magazine transitions really smoothly here, actually, from geopolitics into the Periscope section on employment. And it reveals this anxiety has led to a major new phenomenon they're calling job hugging.
Job hugging. It's a very evocative phrase, isn't it? We should define that clearly for the listener. What does that behavioral shift actually mean?
Okay, so job huggers, as defined here, are professionals who are actively, you know, clinging to their current roles, even if those roles are maybe beneath their skill level or they feel underpaid.
And why?
It's a mix. Financial necessity, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But also this profound fear of limited opportunities elsewhere. It's like a powerful psychological reaction to perceived economic uncertainty, and it's overriding that traditional drive for career advancement.
And there's data backing this up.
Oh, yeah. Compelling research from Top Resume. They found that a staggering 66%, two-thirds of U.S. professionals surveyed, could be classified as job huggers.
Two out of every three people in the professional workforce, primarily motivated by just holding on, by fear, not by getting ahead. That's significant.
It's huge. And that fear, it translates into real quantifiable concessions people are making. Look at these hard facts from the survey. 65% said they would take an overqualified job, a role they're clearly too skilled for.
And many already have.
26% already had taken such a job. But maybe the most alarming stat, the one pointing directly to suppressed wages and reduced mobility, 75% said they would take a pay cut just to keep their current job.
Three quarters would accept less money for security.
And 16% already had accepted a pay cut.
Wow. When you see those numbers, you realize this isn't just about individual choices, is it? Uh-huh. It reflects a broader market condition, a slowing, almost stagnant labor market.
Exactly. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is quoted noting the context driving this fear. Layoffs and hiring remain low. That kind of stability sounds good, but it actually signals a softening market where people rightly get nervous about job security and they just freeze their professional movement.
So it's a mix of financial fear and maybe workplace psychology, too.
Definitely. Right. Mickey Hibble, a professor at Rice University, points this out. Beyond the fear, people are also prioritizing other things, intrinsic benefits like flexibility, less stress, maybe fewer hours. They're consciously accepting lower pay for these things.
Even though studies show pay isn't always the biggest driver of job satisfaction.
Right. There's only a modest correlation shown between salary and overall job satisfaction. So it's this complex equation. Fear intersects with a search for better work-life balance.
So the trade-off is stability and maybe mental health rather than wealth and growth. But what about the long term? What are the career implications of this widespread job hugging? Does it actually protect people or does it set them up for stagnation down the road?
Well, career experts cited in the piece are issuing some major warnings. Amanda Augustine from Top Resume highlights specific risks. By settling for a lower role or taking that pay cut, professionals miss out on crucial salary growth over time.
Right.
They lose momentum in scaling their skills, learning new things, and they severely erode their bargaining power for future negotiations.
I can see the trap there. If you stay in an underqualified role because you're just hugging it, future employers, as Augustine points out, might just assume that current lower role reflects your true market level.
Exactly. Which makes it incredibly difficult to bounce back later and get the salary your experience should command. It becomes this kind of systemic, self-fulfilling prophecy of career stagnation. The fear of today actively limits the potential of tomorrow.
That's a sobering thought, but the report offers another perspective too, right?
Yeah.
It's not all negative.
It's balanced, yes. Jennifer Shiko of Summit Group Solutions argues that job hugging can actually be seen as a positive choice sometimes for mental health, for work-life balance.
How so?
Shuka suggests that by intentionally downshifting, individuals take control of their environment. They actively reduce stress. And often, they find they can outperform expectations in that less demanding role because the pressure is lower.
So it's a calculated move, trading career acceleration for maybe a higher quality of life, better well-being?
Potentially, yes. It highlights a fundamental shift, perhaps, in how the current workforce is defining what professional success even means. Maybe it's not always about climbing the ladder anymore.
That psychological shift where stability might trump scaling, that feels like a defining trait of this moment. Which actually brings us nicely to another major turning point. This one, a seismic political event from the recent past, told through the eyes of one of the administration's most visible figures. We're pivoting now to some high-stakes political history.
Yes, we're moving into the Periscope books section.
Yeah.
And this is explosive stuff. An exclusive excerpt from Karine Jean-Pierre's new book. The title tells you a lot. Independent. A look inside a broken White House. Outside the party lines.
And this excerpt gives the definitive inside account, doesn't it? Revealing the precise moment President Biden dropped out of the 2024 race.
And crucially, why she subsequently abandoned the Democratic Party.
It sounds like a real moment-by-moment recounting, a TikTok of that political earthquake. It all happened on Sunday, more than July 21st, 2024. And the context is vital, right? Biden was vacationing in Rehoboth, Delaware.
And just tested positive for COVID.
Amidst all this intense public chatter about his future after that difficult debate performance.
Right. The setting itself just amplified the drama. KJP describes glancing at her phone around 1 p.m. and seeing this unexpected invite. A Zoom meeting in 45 minutes for senior advisors.
Just popped up.
Yeah. And she notes in the book the invitation left her deeply unsettled. She felt, quote, it had to be one of two things, one of the scenarios unimaginable. That sense of foreboding.
So 1.45 p.m., she gets on the Zoom. Who was there?
The senior advisors, LeBolt, Perez, Benjamin, plus the top campaign leadership, Jennifer Mally Dellen, Michael Tyler, Quentin Folks, and crucially, President Biden himself.
And the suspense didn't last long.
Apparently not. Biden logged on and just delivered the news straight up. He was withdrawing from the race.
Wow. And his reasoning, according to KJP?
He felt the party, his own party, had done so much damage to his campaign that there was just no coming back. He confirmed he'd finish his term, exit the presidential race, and endorse Harris. A formal statement was imminent.
Her reaction. The book captures it.
Oh, vividly. It's portrayed as this profound mix of personal and political betrayal. She writes, she was stunned, my feelings a blur, angry and sad, enraged and heartbroken.
That emotional intensity is key. She felt this man, who'd given 50 years to public service, was treated poorly, essentially discarded by elements within his own party.
Yes. And the shockwave went wide. She notes that even senior advisor Anita Dunn, arguably one of the most powerful people in his inner circle, didn't know the decision was coming beforehand.
So KJP, as press secretary, immediately faced managing the media firestorm.
Right. And she decided to proceed with her already scheduled Tuesday appearance on The View, a huge platform, the goal, to lift up the president, shift the narrative away from withdrawal and towards his legacy.
And what about the press corps on the ground in Delaware, given he had COVID?
They made a controversial call, according to the excerpt, decided not to change protocol or brief reporters directly about the withdrawal at that moment. They stuck to just releasing the daily letter from the president's physician about his COVID status.
Which the White House Correspondents Association probably wasn't thrilled about.
The book acknowledges they weren't happy, no. But KJP and the team stuck to their strategy. But the long-term impact on her, that was personal and transformative.
This profound disappointment in the party, driven by how she felt Biden was treated, that became the catalyst for her own radical political decision.
Exactly. She writes, she realized she couldn't stomach giving blind loyalty to a party I felt no longer deserved it. And that led directly to her decision to register as an independent, channeling that hurt, that disillusionment, into concrete political action, leaving the party she'd served.
And her post-White House analysis of the Democratic Party, detailed in the book, it's quite critical, isn't it?
Very much so. She asserts the party is fundamentally a big tent, but she stresses that things like racism and misogyny are still undeniably present. She argues the party needs to constantly fight to keep it genuinely inclusive and, crucially, avoid excluding voices, even voices critical of the establishment.
She also tackles that idea of the purity test in politics.
Yeah, she suggests Black women in particular understand the real world stakes. They consistently show up and vote for Democrats, citing 92% for Harris as an example, even if they don't always hear exactly what they want from the party platform.
Because the alternative is worse.
Precisely. They understand the detriment of losing to someone like Donald Trump is too great to risk demanding ideological purity. It's presented as a pragmatic approach to political power.
And this analysis leads her to a final call to action for the Democrats.
It does. She argues the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, needs to operate like a true opposition party. Get outside its comfort zone. Push back against the authoritarian that we're seeing right now, she writes.
And she delivers a line that probably resonates with a lot of voters.
Yeah.
Something about wanting leaders, not just strongly worded letters.
That's the one. Voters want leaders, not another strongly worded letter. And she explicitly warns, if the Democratic Party can't provide that strong, visible leadership people are demanding, voters will go elsewhere.
Which, she implies, is why she went elsewhere herself, becoming an independent. It's a really powerful narrative of disillusionment leading to self-determination.
Absolutely. And, you know, that kind of dramatic turning point in modern political history, it actually sets the stage perfectly for examining the fundamental turning point in American history itself.
Ah, good transition. From the intense drama of D.C., we move to Ken Burns's deep dive into the nation's founding story.
Exactly. We're turning now to the feature deep dive on filmmaker Ken Burns. He's tackling what he calls, and this is quite a claim, the most important event in the history of the world since the birth of Christ.
Whoa. He's talking about America's Revolutionary War, setting the intellectual stakes incredibly high with that statement.
Well, Burns' legacy alone gives this project immense weight, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You have to remember the scale of his past success. The Civil War, back in 1990, drew nearly 40 million viewers, averaged 14 million a night.
Still the most popular program ever on PBS, right? He basically created the template for that kind of shared national historical television event.
He did. And this new series, The American Revolution, it looks set to replicate that model, but for the streaming age. It's a 12-hour epic premiering Sunday, November 16th, running for 6 consecutive nights.
Even though people can probably binge it all at once on streaming, that 6-night run still encourages that communal viewing experience he pioneered.
Right. Now, Burns' central thesis, this really drives the film's narrative. He sees the revolution not as some simple, heroic tale of noble patriots.
The way we often learn it in school.
Exactly. But as a messy and even hypocritical battle of ideas. It was Enlightenment principles, liberty, individual rights grafted onto this new country that was still deeply rooted in problematic colonial practices.
And he starts by kind of dismantling the romanticized images we all carry, like Washington crossing the Delaware.
That iconic painting by Emmanuel Lucy, Washington standing heroically in the boat. Burns points out the basic reality. He's not standing up in that boat. He forces us to question the very images that form our national myth.
And the film focuses squarely on the contradictions at the heart of the conflict.
The central, undeniable ones. How could a war fought over liberty and self-governance happen when slavery was the accepted practice, the modus operandi, in all 13 colonies?
And at the same time, the horrific treatment of Native Americans was ongoing.
Right. The film compels us, the viewer, to grapple with that inherent moral complexity right from the founding moment.
And the ultimate embodiment of this hypocrisy has to be the Jefferson paradox, right? Thomas Jefferson, principal architect of the Declaration of Independence,
writes those profound universal words, "All men are created equal."
Yet Jefferson himself owned hundreds of human beings throughout his life, and the vast majority remained enslaved after his death.
And the film, according to this article, uses this contradiction not to, you know, cancel the founders, but to understand them as complex, flawed humans, operating under immense pressure in a world that was fundamentally unfree.
Burns seems very aware of the current cultural debates around historical interpretation.
Very sensitive to it. He stresses, quote, "All of us are walking contradictions. Our tendency right now is to make everything a binary, on or off." He's insistent about the film's intent.
He says it's not woke.
His words. It's not woke. It's just a good story. And a good story requires that you call balls and strikes. He frames it as essential historical reporting, not taking sides in modern political commentary.
Now, technically, this film must have been a massive challenge. The Revolutionary War predates the first camera by, what, 50 years?
Easily. No photos exist of Samuel Adams or Patrick Henry or any of them. So how do you make a 12-hour documentary visually engaging without any contemporary photographic evidence?
Which brings us to the Ken Burns effect, that famous panning and zooming technique.
Which Steve Jobs later formally coined for iMovie, interestingly. It wasn't just a stylistic choice for Burns, it was born of necessity here.
Using it on thousands of lithographs, letters, paintings, hundreds of maps.
To transform those static images into dynamic narrative visual elements. Something that can sustain viewer attention across 12 long hours. It's crucial to the whole endeavor.
And to balance the focus on the big names, the Washingtons, the Jeffersons, the film also tells the story from the bottom up.
Yes, dedicating significant time to lesser-known figures. The article highlights the inclusion of Rebecca Tanner, a Mohegan woman from Connecticut.
And her story is just devastating.
Lost all five of her sons in the fighting. Burns notes this represents more grief, more loss than any other person I know in any war. Focusing on personal tragedies like hers shifts the narrative away from purely political history and grounds it in the immense, often invisible, human cost of the conflict.
The timing of the film's release feels significant, too, near the country's 250th birthday.
And amidst what Burns calls a new national reckoning over political violence. He draws a direct line from the revolution to modern politics.
How so?
He states that the modern theory of nearly unlimited executive power is precisely the thing the founders were trying to build a bulwark against.
That's a powerful cautionary note for today. He concludes with that iconic exchange, right? After the Constitutional Convention in 1787, Benjamin Franklin.
Yes, prompted by Elizabeth Willing Powell asking, "What have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And Franklin's stark reply, "A republic if you can keep it."
And Burns offers his takeaway on how we keep it.
The way you keep it is to know the complexity of your history. The film, therefore, is presented as a necessity, a tool for maintaining the republic by forcing us to understand its fundamentally flawed, complex, and contradictory origins.
That depth of historical analysis, that grappling with complexity, it feels essential for moving forward. And speaking of progress and complexity, let's move from the founding of the nation to measuring excellence in the present day, specifically in healthcare.
Good segue. We turn now to another feature deep dive, this one meticulously ranking America's best in state hospitals for 2026.
This is an annual ranking from Newsweek and Statista, right? Designed to help people focus on getting well instead of finding a reliable hospital, which, given the huge variation in quality across the country's 6,000 plus hospitals, is incredibly valuable data.
Absolutely invaluable. And the methodology, that's what really elevates this ranking beyond just opinion or anecdote. It sets a standard, really, for what quality healthcare should look like. And it expanded this year, too.
From 700 hospitals last year to 800.
Right. 800 top facilities across all 50 states and D.C. are included in the 2026 ranking.
And the whole thing is built on four core pillars. The weighting of these pillars tells you a lot about what they prioritize.
Exactly. Data-driven quality metrics and professional reputation clearly dominate the final score.
Okay, let's break down the biggest pillar first. Hospital quality metrics. That accounts for a full 50% of the total score. Where does all that quantitative data come from?
It's pulled from highly rigorous established sources. You've got data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, Medicare Fee-for-Service claims data, the American Hospital Association's annual survey.
And there's an update there this year, something about staffing.
Crucial update. New staffing metrics were added to the AHA data analysis this year. Things like nurse-to-patient ratios, physician availability, recognizing that adequate staffing is a direct driver of quality outcomes. It's not just about equipment, it's about people.
Makes sense. And this pillar also includes accreditations, sort of stamps of approval from various bodies.
Absolutely critical. Accreditation data is folded in from bodies like the Joint Commission, which certifies thousands of health organizations, Planetary, which focuses specifically on patient-centered care.
There's ANCC Magnet, too, for nursing excellence.
Right. Granted by the American Nurses Credentialing Center, recognizing the best nursing practices. Mm-hmm. And ACHC, which focuses on specialized healthcare services. Basically, if a hospital scores high here, it means they are consistently meeting established, audited standards for care and resources.
Okay, that's half the score right there. Pillar two is hospital reputation, accounting for 30%. This introduces a subjective element, but it's based on peer review.
Exactly. Peer review from the people who know best. This 30% score comes from a massive nationwide survey of medical professionals, doctors, hospital managers, other healthcare providers. They rate hospitals both inside and outside their own state.
On what criteria?
Five main categories. Overall quality of care gets the biggest weight, 45% of this pillar, then patient counseling, 25%, accommodation and amenities, 12.5%, staffing levels, 10%, and accessibility, 7.5%. That high weighting on what other professionals think gives this ranking huge credibility.
Got it. Pillar three, patient experience, accounts for 15%. This uses standardized data, HCAHPS.
Right. HCAHPS stands for Hospital Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems. It's a standardized survey given to patients after discharge.
And it covers
essential things that directly impact the patient's comfort and recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how clean was the hospital? How well did doctors and nurses communicate? How quiet were the rooms at night? Was discharge information clear? It ensures the patient's actual lived experience is quantified and factored in.
Okay. And finally, the smallest pillar, but maybe the most forward-looking, PROMS implementation at 5%.
PROMS, patient-reported outcome measures. This looks at whether hospitals are actively implementing and auditing the use of data reported directly by patients about their own health status, their symptoms, their recovery progress.
So using patient feedback in real time to improve care.
That's the goal. Pushing hospitals to use this real-time patient data to optimize care processes, maybe even therapeutic decisions. It's only 5% of the score now, but its inclusion really signals the future direction. Patient-centered, data-driven medicine.
So this rigorous four-pillar assessment, it really highlights true excellence. The list recognizes top institutions across the map, right?
Yeah, places that have successfully integrated all these metrics. The article mentions a few. Mayo Clinic Hospital in Phoenix, Arizona. Northwestern Memorial in Illinois. The Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, and the world-renowned Cleveland Clinic in Ohio.
It provides a necessary data-driven guide for what are, frankly, some of the most critical decisions we ever make about our health. The depth of scrutiny here seems way beyond just asking around for opinions.
Totally agree. Far outweighs any simple, non-quantifiable recommendation.
Okay, from the precision of healthcare metrics, let's smoothly shift gears, literally this time, to the world of luxury performance.
Ha, nice one.
We're moving to the Periscope Auto section, looking at Ferrari's electric future. The Electrica EV is coming in 2026. This feels like a pivotal, almost existential moment for a brand built entirely on the sound and fury of gasoline engines.
Yeah, you have to wonder how they pull this off. CEO Benedetto Vigna, though, he frames it not as some reluctant concession to regulations, but as a crucial growth strategy.
Growth? How so?
The goal is twofold. One, maintain Ferrari's immense profitability. The article reports an astonishing profit margin, around $136,000 per car sold in the first half of 2025 alone.
Wow! 136K profit per car.
Insane, right? But two, simultaneously open up the market to completely new buyers. People Vigna describes as those who want to only drive electric cars. Tap into that growing demand.
That profit margin is incredible. It really emphasizes why they must succeed in this transition. But this isn't just any EV, it has to be an electric Ferrari. And the development seems deeply informed by their Formula One heritage.
That F1 link is absolutely essential to the brand story, to the marketing. The report traces the lineage clearly. Knowledge gained from the 2009 F399 F1 car influenced the 2012 LaFerrari streetcar.
The hybrid hypercar.
Right, which then informed the later SF90 and F80 hybrids. Now that same high-performance R&D, that DNA, is being injected directly into the battery electric Electrica.
And they're billing it as a new interpretation of sportiness, promising performance better than the old GTC4 Lusso. What kind of numbers are we talking?
Expected specs are over 1,000 horsepower. The article hints likely closer to 1,100 HP when it's finalized, and projected 0 to 62 miles per hour in just 2.5 seconds.
2.5 seconds? That's blistering fast. Puts it squarely in the hyper EV category.
It does. But here's the interesting rub. The challenge may be to Ferrari's identity that the article points out. That 2.5 second time, while incredibly impressive, it's actually bested by several high-performance EVs coming out of China.
Really? Like who?
The article specifically mentions BYD and Zeekr. Newer players beating Ferrari potentially on raw acceleration.
So if rival automakers, even these new electric players, are beating Ferrari on that key benchmark pure speed, doesn't that kind of fundamentally undermine the brand's core claim, their claim to absolute automotive supremacy? How do they maintain that exclusivity?
That's the multi-million dollar question, isn't it? Their answer seems to be through control and innovation. Doubling down on Enzo Ferrari's original ethos of having complete mastery over every single component.
How does that manifest in the EV?
Well, crucially, Ferrari is assembling each battery pack in-house. They are not outsourcing this core technology. They're using specialized robots for this assembly because the rotor and stator units inside have to be aligned with millimeter precision for optimal performance.
That focus on in-house precision, that control, that feels like a massive differentiator from brands just buying battery packs off the shelf. What about the battery specs themselves?
The Electrica uses 15 battery modules sourced from SK On. Each module contains 14 cells. These are then precision welded and fully integrated directly into the car's frame, which also enhances structural rigidity.
And they're thinking about longevity, too.
Big time. Stressing sustainability, noting that 60% of the energy used during factory testing is actually returned to the grid. And their stated goal is profound. A Ferrari is forever, reinforced by the promise of future battery upgrades over the car's life.
Okay. Let's address the elephant in the garage. The sound, or the lack thereof. The throaty roar of a Ferrari V8 or V12, it's as vital to the brand's identity as the prancing horse emblem itself. How are they possibly adapting their most defining auditory characteristic to the relative quiet of electricity?
They've taken a very definitive and, frankly, controversial stance here. Anti-mimicry.
Meaning?
The Electrica will not mimic the sound of an internal combustion engine. No fake V12 noises pumped through the speakers. The report explicitly frames this as a shot across the bow at rivals like Mercedes-AMG, who are using recorded sounds from their past engines to simulate that performance feel.
Okay, so if they aren't simulating the old engine sounds, what is the driver hearing? Silence?
Not exactly silence. They're using what they call acoustic amplification. High-precision sensors pick up the genuine mechanical sounds produced by the EV powertrain, the authentic whirring, the operating components, and they amplify those sounds directly to the driver.
Like a guitar amp for the electric motor.
That's a great analogy. It's an authentic electric sound signature, engineered and amplified, not a recorded fake V12 roar.
That is highly innovative. And they're combining that unique oral feedback with physical feedback too, right? Through paddle shifters.
Exactly. This completes the holistic performance loop they're aiming for. The driver uses physical paddle shifters, but obviously there are no gears to shift in an EV.
So what do the paddles do?
They control the torque and power allocation through 5 distinct levels. And using these paddles provides tactile feedback, capable of delivering the physical sensation of engine braking, for instance. It's an attempt to translate the feeling and the control of driving a combustion engine into the electric age, keeping the driver completely involved in the performance, even without that roaring V12 soundtrack.
It's clear this transition for Ferrari is a highly controlled, incredibly precise step into the future, driven by maintaining both performance superiority and brand heritage, even if that heritage now needs to be electronically refined and reinterpreted.
Absolutely. And, you know, that kind of profound dedication to craft, that obsession with the control, it's actually a recurring theme in this issue of Newsweek.
How so?
Well, shifting now from the luxury of Italian engineering to the immersive dedication of American and French artists. We examine 3 high-profile interviews in the culture section, and they all detail these deep, almost obsessive personal commitments to their art.
Okay, where do we start?
We start with Ethan Hawke and Blue Moon in the film section. This project highlights a decade-long wait for the right moment and the enduring power of a creative partnership.
This is his film with Richard Linklater, right? They've worked together a lot.
Blue Moon marks their 9th feature-length collaboration. Incredible partnership. And they've apparently been discussing this particular film, which focuses on the life of the brilliant but troubled lyricist Lorenz Hart, for about a decade.
A decade? What was the holdup?
Linklater initially felt Hawke was simply too young for the part. Hart was an alcoholic who died tragically young at 48. The film focuses intensely on the very end of his life in 1943. Hawke basically had to age into the role over those 10 years.
Wow. And the film's structure sounds intense, too. It focuses on just 90 minutes of real time, all set in one location.
Yeah, a recreation of the famous Sardi's restaurant in New York. That single continuous scene is the emotional epicenter. It centers around the premiere night of the smash hit musical Oklahoma.
Which was a triumph for Hart's former partner, Richard Rodgers, working with Oscar Hammerstein II for the first time.
Exactly. So the backdrop of this enormous success for his old partner only serves to emphasize Lorenz Hart's own personal and professional decline at that moment. It makes the scene intensely painful, poignant, transitional.
And Hawke's commitment to playing Hart, it was significant.
Physically demanding, for sure. The article mentions he required a shaved head, and they used significant on-set stagecraft, things like hidden trenches built into the floor, precise camera angles, all to make the 54-year-old Hawk appear balding and physically smaller, closer to Hart's actual 5-foot-nothing stature.
He really threw himself into it.
His quote about the role really tells you about his dedication. He embraced the difficulty, stating, "I would never be good enough to do the part justice." That's the voice of an artist so committed to the subject that the challenge feels almost insurmountable, which paradoxically drives them even deeper.
He also reflects a bit on the dynamics of that long collaboration with Linklater.
Yeah, he admits he once felt kind of possessive when Linklater worked with other actors, like Keanu Reeves in A Scanner Darkly. But that experience led him to this profound personal realization. Friends are harder to find than work. The collaborative loyalty, that shared history, he suggests, is ultimately more valuable than any single project.
That's a great insight. Okay, who's next in culture?
Next, we move to Nicholas Sparks and remain in the spotlight section. Sparks, obviously known for his signature sweeping romantic novels.
Well, a notebook, yeah.
Right. But his new novel, Remain, apparently presents this really unique narrative constraint that forces him to change his entire formula.
What's the constraint?
It's described as a difficult love story where the two central characters can't touch. They can't eat together. They can't even go anywhere together.
Wow. For a writer whose brand is built on physical intimacy, shared journeys, sweeping embraces, how do you even maintain tension and romance under those conditions? Must have been an immense challenge.
Had to be. And interestingly, it was also a conscious collaboration with a master from a completely different genre. Director M. Night Shyamalan.
Shyamalan is adapting the book into a film.
That's the plan. And Sparks apparently partnered with him on the story idea from the start, hoping to cross-pollinate their audiences, you know, draw Shyamalan's thriller suspense fans to his novel, and maybe Sparks romance readers to the film. A very modern multi-platform strategy.
And he gives his readers a very specific, almost meta instruction, too, about visualizing the main character.
He does. Sparks explicitly tells readers they can Google the actor Jake Gyllenhaal if they want to visualize Tate, the lead character in the novel. That's a really unique way to bridge that gap between the text on the page and the potential cinematic visualization. Very 2025.
Ah, indeed. And he reflects a bit on his legacy, The Notebook.
Yeah, quite modestly. Notes that The Notebook obviously changed his life completely, and he's just honored that it's still lingering after 30 years. That kind of endurance really is the hallmark of a true cultural phenomenon, isn't it?
It really is. Okay, and the third profile.
Finally, we turn to the acclaimed French actress Marion Cotillard in the parting shot section. She's discussing her new role in the popular TV series The Morning Show.
Right, she joined the cast, playing Céline Dumont, the new board president of UBA, the fictional news network at the heart of the show.
And Cotillard finds her core philosophy as an actress through this lens of intensity, of obsession. She states, quite directly, "I need to get obsessed by projects so I can be involved. I want to be entirely disappearing in a project." That deep commitment is why she took on her first major TV role.
And she found the TV pace and format different from film.
Very different, she says. She apparently relied heavily on advice she received from her co-star, Billy Crudup.
What did he tell her?
He gave her this very practical, maybe slightly surprising direction. Give your total trust and be a happy puppet. Let them direct you. Basically, trust the showrunners and directors in the faster-paced TV environment.
Interesting advice. What drew her to The Morning Show specifically?
She felt it was the first time she'd seen a character involved in the hashtag MeToo revolution, presumably referring to Steve Carell's character, genuinely reflect on the harm he caused. She also found the show's ongoing commentary on modern journalism really compelling.
The shift away from objectivity towards more opinion-driven media.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She found that both compelling and challenging to portray as the head of the network.
You know, that focus on profound personal commitment, that need she has to disappear into a project, it ties back beautifully to what we were saying about Ferrari's dedication to in-house precision. It's all about total control, total immersion in the artistic or technical output.
That's a great connection. Mm-hmm. And Cotillard recalls a moment where that genuine commitment, that lack of calculation, manifested very publicly. Her iconic, yet completely unprepared, Oscar speech when she won for La Vie en Rose.
Oh, yes. Resulting in that famous emotional quote, "There must be angels in the city."
She notes that explosion of emotion was very genuine and not prepared. That raw honesty, that lack of artifice, seems integral to her whole approach to acting.
So these three profiles, Hawk, Sparks, Cotillard, they really underscore a shared truth, don't they? Whether the medium is film, TV, or the novel, Achieving great art seems to require this radical personal dedication, often involving overcoming significant constraints or long waiting periods.
Well said. Now, before we wrap up and synthesize all these threads, we absolutely must honor our commitment to being comprehensive. We need to quickly touch on the global and historical snapshots included at the very back of the magazine.
Right, the shorter items that provide that crucial wider context. Let's start with the In Focus Global Events section. First up, Gaza aid.
Okay, the report details World Food Program aid being delivered in Deir al-Bala, Gaza, on October 16th. This happened during a brief but critical ceasefire that was brokered by the U.S. and Gulf states.
And the volume of aid.
During that truce, a daily average of 560 metric tons of food managed to enter Gaza. However, deliveries were briefly halted again on October 19th after Israeli airstrikes resumed nearby.
Underscoring the fragility of the situation.
Exactly. But deliveries did successfully resume the following day, which is positive. It just highlights the extreme volatility of getting aid distributed on the ground there.
Okay. Next, something completely different. The sumo tradition in London. This sounds fascinating.
It really does. A grand sumo tournament was actually held at London's Royal Albert Hall on October 16th. And this was only the second time in the entire 1,500-year history of sumo that such a major tournament was held outside of Japan.
Only the second time. When was the first?
Way back in 1991. So this was a truly rare cultural moment.
And they went to great lengths for authenticity.
Absolute commitment to tradition. To construct the dohio, the sacred ring, they literally shipped 11 tons of special Japanese clay all the way to London.
11 tons of clay.
Incredible. The tournament ran for 5 days, and Yokozuna Hoshoryu emerged as the winner. It just highlights this rare, amazing intersection of ancient, deeply ritualized tradition and modern international exhibition.
Amazing. We also note a somber event, the final journey of a major African political figure in Nairobi, Kenya.
Yes, the procession for former Prime Minister and longtime opposition leader Raila Odinga was held on October 16th. Odinga had died at age 80 in India the day before.
He was a significant figure in Kenyan politics for decades, wasn't he?
Hugely significant. A consistent, powerful advocate for democracy. He served as prime minister from 2008 to 2013. But his entire career, spanning decades, was really defined by his persistent challenge of one-party rule and his dedication to democratic reform. He leaves a complex but undoubtedly enduring political legacy.
Okay. And finally, just a brief mention from the U.S. domestic front. A headline reading, "Tensions flare in Chicago." Just a short snapshot indicating some ongoing localized volatility or political struggle in the city.
Right. Now, let's quickly hit the rewind section, pulling crucial historical context from Newsweek's own archives, reminding us how much or sometimes how little things have changed.
Okay. Starting with 2001 military. This article focuses on the demanding path from being an elite Army Ranger to joining the 5th Special Forces Group, the legendary Green Beret.
And the process is described as intensely selective, which is no surprise. The transition involves this grueling 24-day ordeal called the Special Forces Assessment and Selection Course, or SFAS.
And pass rate is low.
Only about a third of participants typically pass this initial trial, which tests everything physical, mental, cognitive endurance. Those who make it through then proceed to the year-long Q course, to finally earn the right to wear the Green Beret. It just underscores the immense selectivity and investment required to create America's special operators.
Okay, now jumping back further to 1981, health. This piece highlights how dramatically cancer survival rates have improved over the decades.
It's really striking. Back in 1981, Newsweek reported that just over 40% of cancer victims could be saved. And that was considered a major victory at the time, up significantly from only 25% just 30 years prior to that, around 1950.
40% seemed like huge progress then. What's the comparison point today?
The progress since 81 is staggering. Recent American Cancer Society figures covering the period 2014-2020 show the overall 5-year survival rate for all cancers combined is now significantly higher. It's reached 69%.
Wow, from 40% in 81 to 69% now. That represents a monumental scientific and medical achievement over just 4 decades.
Truly monumental.
And finally, a look back at 1994, culture. Focusing on television, specifically the origins of the medical drama genre with ER.
Which is now seen as this iconic genre-defining show. But initially, it was a really hard sell. Creator Michael Crichton is quoted from back then saying, "Every network has seen it over the years, and they basically didn't like it."
Hard to believe now, every network passed on ER?
Apparently so.
Yeah.
That rejection seems incredible today because the medical drama is now a staple, a pillar of network TV. The article notes that 6 new medical dramas premiered in the 2024-2025 season alone.
Including one starring ER's original lead, Noah Weil.
Exactly, The Pitt, plus others like Dr. Odyssey and Pulse. It just shows how a concept once deemed unmarketable can eventually become this foundational evergreen genre that defines a whole generation of television.
These snapshots from military standards to health breakthroughs to cultural trends, they really do underscore the breadth of forces constantly shaping our world, often unseen until you place them side by side like this.
Absolutely. So let's try and bring it all together. We've navigated some really complex geopolitical shifts today, haven't we? Examining the pressures on smaller states like Slovenia and the potentially corrosive effect of the U.S. challenging established international law.
We definitely did. And we explored that evolving, quite emotional landscape of the U.S. labor market, where this deep financial anxiety seems to be driving the job-hugging phenomenon and potentially suppressing career mobility for many.
Then we witnessed that incredibly dramatic political exit right through the eyes of an insider, Karine Jean-Pierre, detailing the moment a president stepped away from a campaign and how that spurred his press secretary to leave the Democratic Party herself out of this profound disillusionment.
And we explored those essential, uncomfortable contradictions right at the heart of America's founding story, viewed through the exhaustive, non-binary lens of Ken Burns, trying to understand complexity, not simplify it.
It's clear, isn't it? Whether we're talking about the high-precision world of Ferrari's electric vehicles, where performance itself has to be electronically engineered and redefined, or the exhaustive four-pillar methodology used for ranking hospitals, where patient outcomes and professional reputation are rigorously measured and prioritized.
The unifying theme across all these disparate sources seems to be this constant drive. A drive to excel, to adapt, often by ruthlessly scrutinizing history or current practices or even deeply held beliefs.
Yeah, the material offers so many insights on the nature of belief and commitment itself. Whether it's Marion Cotillard needing to disappear into a project to do her best work.
Or the Slovenian president prioritizing multilateralism even when facing strong political headwinds.
Or Ethan Hawke waiting patiently for a decade for the right moment to tackle a challenging role. Success in all these fields seems predicated on this profound, often difficult kind of dedication.
It really does.
You know, we heard Ken Burns discuss how really knowing the complexity, the contradictions of our history is what permits us to design a future that's actually in keeping with where we truly came from.
Right.
So considering that, and then thinking about Karine Jean-Pierre's move to political independence, which was born of this profound disappointment in a party she had served and championed for decades, it makes you wonder, what deeply held political or social belief have you, the listener, carried for years that maybe upon deeper examination of the evidence might now require a similarly radical reassessment?
That's a powerful question to leave people with, something to definitely mull over until our next deep dive.
Indeed.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the Newsweek USA issue for the week of October 31st, 2025.